Okay, welcome back. I'm going to check the preferences real quick. And looks like my microphone is plugged in. This is kind of frustrating. I just recorded like an entire episode and then the GarageBand, which is the recording application I use, just shut down. So that really pissed me off. So episode 43 or 44, take two. Anyway, you heard the last episode, or those of you that listened to the last episode, well, you can just see how truly disgusting this thing was, and you can just see what this addiction will do to a person. It's just the most god-awful, disgusting, filthy thing that any human being could ever do is that, and this is like the pinnacle of it all. This is the climax. This is the culmination of all of it. It's just that filth, just that disgusting filth. And there was maybe another week or two that it went on. I don't really know. I can't remember. I do remember that my friend Andrew was in town with his girlfriend Megan, and she's now his wife. But we were like hanging out. Like we went to a Cubs game together, and I was like shooting up in the bathroom at Wrigley Field, and that's just awful. And then it just got, you know, worse and worse and worse. I remember like running from the police, trying to buy some stuff one afternoon, and you know, just I'm kind of starting to be like more friends, sort of not friends, but like junky friends with these fucktards down there, and it was just awful. There was just no place to go. And then on June 6th, I believe, or June 5th, something like that, 2007, it was the 5th or the 6th, I had been down to the West Side, and I had gotten my stuff, and I had come back, and I was laying on the couch. It was like 11 in the morning. I was laying on my parents' couch, and my mom said, "Why don't you call that treatment center?" And I had gotten myself onto a waiting list for a free government-run treatment center in like April or something like that in the spring. And for whatever reason, like the mixture of the alcohol and the dope was just right in that moment. And for whatever reason, I said, okay. And I was just like, I'll do it. I'll call them. So I got up and I called the treatment center and they said, "We have room for you." It's like, oh, really? I kind of just want to hang out here and do this some more, you know, but it's time to make a change. So they're like, "You need to get into this detox center first." And they referred me to a detox center on the far north side of Chicago, which is interesting because it's like right where I ended up living for the next 10 years, almost 10 years. But I had no idea where this was at the time. I had never been that far north. It was up in Edgewater. And I called the detox center and they're like, "Yeah, come in tomorrow at this time. We'll check you in." And so it's like, okay. And you know, so I'm like, I guess this is it. I guess this is over, you know? And I called a couple of friends, my friend John and his girlfriend Lauren. They came over that night and they gave me some Klonopin, some drugs to smuggle in to make the withdrawal not as bad. And I kind of prepared. And then the next morning, which I believe would have been June 6th, I believe this is June 6th, 2007, I woke up and I went down. I did one more run. I went to the city again. I got a couple of bags or whatever. I don't know where I had the money. I remember I had told I was still working a couple days a week. So I told them what was going on, and you know, I was just such a wreck. I mean, I was just so fucked. I mean, my life was just so just completely fucked. It was just shattered into a trillion little pieces, and it was just like this mirror was staring back at me in this fragmented versions of myself, and it was just awful. And it was there was just nowhere to go. And so I that last day I went down, I got some dope, and went home and got high down in the city and went home. And then my dad drove me down there, and I checked in, and it was so hot. It was like 100 degrees. It was just this early summer. It was at least in the 90s, and it was just this nasty place. It was a non-medical detox. It was just like just this really gross place. And there were rubber sheets, a pillow covered in this like rubber liner that they give you, this sort of like paper type of cloth pillowcase cover thing, kind of like hospital style. It's just gross. I was the only white, there were like three white guys in there and me, and then all these black people, and my roommate was Puerto Rican. His name was Anthony. And the black people were kind of like not really friendly. They were kind of racist. And then the three white guys, they were these like DuPage County hobos, and they were like super racist. So they'd be like, and they had their own room. And so they were just throwing the N-word around left and right. And I didn't like them either. And I didn't, the African-American people weren't particularly friendly at all and kind of rowdy and loud. And I'm just trying to come off heroin. And it was awful. And, you know, the first day is fine because you get there and you're high and you're like, I'm getting sober. You're all optimistic. But it's when you wake up the next day that you're like, this is real. You're like, this is real. Good Lord. But there was some level of acceptance that had happened that kind of made it easier this time. And I'd like to say that was the end, but I actually got this wild notion on the 10th of June to sneak out the back door of the detox center, which I managed to do somehow, run down the street, buy a bottle of liquor. I bought some rum, and then I snuck back in the back door of this place without getting caught. Now, if they had caught me, I'd have been fucked. I have no idea how I pulled this shit off. I just have no clue. I somehow managed to sneak out the back door of it locks and closes behind you. I like went out the back door and stuck a newspaper in the door, wedged a newspaper in the door, and I was gone for probably at least 10 minutes, you know. It could have plenty of time for somebody to discover that the door was wedged open. And you can't just walk back in there. It's all locked and buzzed in, and I basically snuck out the fire door in the back and snuck this bottle of liquor in and ended up chugging that bottle. And so my last drink of liquor was on June 10th, 2007. So I woke up on June 11th and from being passed out, essentially, and it's just feeling so nasty. And I stashed the bottle in my suitcase or wherever. And I don't know what the hell possessed me there other than the devil. But something happened when I was in this detox center where, like, there was some level of acceptance. And I just didn't I started to look. There was no structure there. It was just just so hot. It was so hot. There's no air conditioning, and there's a bunch of crackheads and crack whores, and there's me, who's a crackhead, and, you know, almost a crack whore, I don't know. And my roommate, he was going through the same thing, Anthony, and we would sit up and we would talk at night. And my friend Kim brought me some cigarettes and a book by Dostoevsky called The Brothers Karamazov. So I was reading The Brothers Karamazov in there. And it was just kind of like, okay, I'm going to be up for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 nights in a row, and I'm just going to accept it. And I just accepted it. And when you accept it, the ants marching in your veins, like I talked about in a much earlier episode, it's just not as bad. You're just like, I'm just going to be awake, and it's just going to kind of suck. And, you know, I threw up a few times, and it's just really gross. Like, your sex drive starts to come back, and it's just like, any junkie will tell you this, when your sex drive starts to come back and it's like uncontrollable. And so you just know that everybody who's coming off dope is like jerking off in the shower and stuff. And it's like, it's just really gross. I don't want to get any more graphic, although I have gotten pretty goddamn graphic in this podcast. But when your sex drive comes back, it's like you touch your dick and you will ejaculate. This is after like three or four days. And it's just like limp dick ejaculation. And I've heard all sorts of junkies say the same thing. This is their experience when the sex drive comes back. So this is like, because it just gets shut off for so long. So this is like what's happening. I'm just this like, my life has been completely annihilated. And it's like, how do you start to put your life back together from what you've done to it? And you got court cases ahead of me. You know, what do you do? Where do you begin? And it just started with literally like picking up my toothbrush and brushing my teeth. And then it evolved into like, okay, I'll take a shower. You know, and then it was like, 2 or 3 days later I could eat a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And then 4 or 5, you know, and then a couple days after that, you know, 4 or 5 days you're looking forward to eating. And then there were meetings. So there were people that would come in and they would share their experience of recovering from addiction. And I would start to look forward to them because it was the only structure. There was no structure here except there would be like a meeting in the morning or at like noon and then one at like 6 o'clock where someone would come in and share their experience of recovery. And I remember we watched the Oprah Winfrey show one day. There was this like day room sort of slash cafeteria that had this television from the 80s that like you literally had to change the channel with your hand and it had this tinfoil antenna thing attached to the top of it, like old school antenna that someone had wrapped tinfoil around to make it a better antenna or like out of a coat hanger or something. And we were watching, it got like one channel and I think we were watching Oprah Winfrey one morning and Mary J. Blige was on Oprah Winfrey and she was sharing her experience of recovery. And I remember everybody, it was like the one moment in that experience where everyone got along. We were just watching Mary J. Blige. She like did a performance and then she was talking about her experience with addiction and recovery and, you know, her being a crackhead and whatever. And you get so emotional when you're coming off this stuff because your emotions have been squashed for so long. I remember getting really emotional about it and just being really inspired. Like, I want this thing. You know, this is... You know, I just risked my entire life. Like, I would have gone to prison if I got caught sneaking a bottle of liquor back into this detox center, right? This is how, and then kind of moving beyond that and then starting to kind of see something for myself and just being so sick and uncomfortable, but just like settling into it, just being like, yeah, my life's going to suck for a while. There's this guy, Reggie, in there, this black guy named Reggie, and he was going to the same treatment center as I was, and so him and I kind of buddied up. He turned out to be kind of a tool, but him and I kind of buddied up while we were in there. And my roommate and I buddied up. He was this gangbanger, this Spanish Cobra gangbanger was the name of his gang. And he was like a high-ranking gang member. And he would tell me all these stories of going to prison and being at Stateville in the 90s when it was really bad. And he told me he had so much fun in there because he had all this rank because his uncle was like the leader of the gang. And I was super fascinated by this guy because he was telling me all these stories of what it's like to be a gangbanger and to shoot people and to be shot at. Him and I really got along. We really kind of got each other through these long nights. And I would do Sudokus and I would read this book for hours at a time. And it took my mind off things. And then I would look forward to the next person coming in. Now, I think I spent 13 days in this place, and it was like maybe the second to the last day or the last day when I was actually supposed to get transported from the detox center to the treatment center, which is like out in the suburbs. You know, they have like a deal worked out between the two places. It was the second to the last night, or maybe it was the last night that I was there, and something had shifted in these like 9 or 10 days since I had that last drink. Something had really shifted. I really started to want this thing. And then at 4 in the morning, for whatever reason, they did this room raid. They raided it. They raided my room. And they're like, you're acting suspicious. We need to search your stuff. So they started searching through my bags. And what do they find? They find the bottle of liquor that I had, empty bottle of liquor that I had ever so non-smartly hidden. I put it underneath a pile of socks or something, like right there. Like, it's really not a, wouldn't take a genius to find this thing. And they find this empty bottle. It's like 4 in the morning. This other guy comes in and he gives me a breathalyzer, and the breathalyzer's clean. It's 00, you know? And he says something to the effect of, oh, it must have already been in there or something. But this other lady wanted to kick me out. And she was like, pack your shit. It's like 4:30 in the morning. She's like, pack your shit. You're getting out of here. You got to go. We can't have this. And so I started to pack my shit. I'm like, man, this is all this work the last 10 days, and they're going to throw me out in the street. And they told me to wait until the manager got there. The manager got there at like 6 a.m., like really early, like super early. And it's this old black woman. And I didn't know how to explain myself. She's like, "What happened?" And I'm like, "I don't know. I don't really remember what I said to her or what she said to me, except, I mean, I don't remember like the preceding conversation that led up to this moment, but what she said to me was, if you want to stay here and if you want to go to treatment tomorrow, I need you to get down on your knees and beg me to let you stay. She said, I need you to beg me. And I did. I got down on my knees and I just said, please, please, please. And this woman held the fate of my soul in the palm of her hands. She knew it. She literally controlled my destiny in that moment. She had all of the power that any human being has ever had over me. Like, literally. She said, beg. And I begged. And she said, okay, you can stay. For whatever reason, by the grace of whatever, she said I could stay. And that was a turning point in my life. And I look back and I just see her as one of the helpers, one of the angels. So we'll go ahead and wrap up there and continue on with the saga. Thanks again for listening. Dave Keenest, Addiction and Redemption. Bye.